This is an audio version of a presentation called What Economics Can't Tell You About Money. And it's number AE605, so you could Google on that, or you could get it straight from altruists.org/AE605. My name's Robin Upton, and I published this in January 2011. Having the graphics will definitely help you understand it, but I'm making it for a radio audience, so I hope you'll be able to understand a lot of it anyway. It's in five sections, and I'm going over a set of research which is not done by economists. So these are mainly results from other disciplines, sociology, advertising, looking incidentally at discoveries about how money affects people's minds, how it affects their decision making, but this is about the real-world effect of money on people. And strange as it may seem, economics doesn't generally look at that. Economics is more about models, about mathematical assumptions. And this is in five sections. And the first one is called Money as Motivation. Now, economics assumes everybody wants more money. Whatever you're offering people, economics assumes if you sweeten it with enough money, people will go for that. So, this incidental result from a US blood bank from 1973 is an interesting one in that context, because they had a list of former donors, and they asked the donors, would you like to give blood again? But they split them into two groups. Group A were asked a simple question, would you like to give blood again? And 93% of people said, yeah, all right, I'll come along and give blood. Group B said, would you like to give blood again, and if you do so, we'll give you a $10 reward. So, if you're asked to give blood again, 93% of people said yes. If you're asked to give blood again and offered an extra $10 for doing so, what percentage do you think would say, yeah, we'll do that? Well, it was 65. So, second example. In Wolfenschiessen, Switzerland, in the 1990s, adult residents were asked about siting a local nuclear waste processing facility. Considering it has to be built somewhere, and this is a suitable place, would you support its construction? 51% of people said, all right, you can plant it here, we won't mind. Now, the local government thought 51% of people, that's a fairly thin majority. I think we'd better sweeten the deal. We'll offer people some compensation, a bonus, because it is a bit of a health risk. So they were asked, would you support its construction if we give you a reward for doing so, of up to $8,700? So if 51% of people said yes without the money, given the reward, the number of people plummeted to 25. So that is not what economics expects. How does money work as a disincentive? This is in the real world. In economics, of course, it's always an incentive. Everybody always wants more money. In the real world, money crowds out other motives. When people think about money, they adopt a selfish mentality. So the blood donors were thinking, $10 and I've got to go there, and I've got to take some of my blood out, that sounds painful, and perhaps I'll be without blood for a while, that's going to disturb me. All for a measly $10, perhaps I won't bother this time. So that was when they were thinking about money. If they weren't thinking about money, they were thinking, blood bank, basically, you give a bit of blood, it doesn't cost you too much, heck, you can make some more blood, and that guy who gets the blood, whoever it is, they're going to be really glad that there was blood there, because that could be a lifesaver. Of course, that's a good deal. So when you think about money, you think selfishly. So those people with the nuclear waste facility thought, well, perhaps it's got to be here somewhere. Let's have it here. Once money was involved, they started to weigh up health risk. Perhaps we don't want it. So this is worrying news if we're attaching price tags to more and more things, because when people see those price tags, then they switch from a whole variety of different motivations and thought patterns to the market. What is in it for me personally? Now, the second section, relationship to pain. Now, this is a deceptively simple but effective experiment. The experimental subjects were asked to put their hand in some hot water and then rate how painful it was. And there were two groups. One group of people counted banknotes before they put their hand in the hot water. Another group of people counted plain paper, the same size as the banknotes, but without anything printed on them. It wasn't money. So they were given this task, well, while you're waiting, could you help by counting this number of pieces of paper, or could you help by counting this money? They weren't made aware that this was part of the experiment. And the remarkable thing is that the people who were counting the paper were slightly more distressed on average than the people who were counting the money. And you can see the graph, it's not actually very much, there's not a lot in it. So on its own, that's not terribly significant, but they had arranged for another factor to be included, which they call social exclusion. It was a rigged computer game, so in fact, it didn't involve other people, it just involved the computer, but they thought it did. And it was about passing the ball. So imagine if you're playing a game of passing the ball in a circle and nobody bothers, they skip over you. Then you think, hey, what's going on here? Why didn't anybody want to play with me? And they told the experimental subjects, yeah, there are other people in the other room. The computer is mediating your playing. So the treatment was normal, which is that you get to play in turn, as you would expect, and social exclusion, which is that for reasons that you didn't know, that is, for reasons which weren't explained to the experimental subject, i.e. the game was rigged, nobody passed them the ball, so they didn't get to play. And so, compare the graph with the minor difference of counting money and counting paper with the socially excluded graph. The pain is more for people who have been exposed to this sort of fake social exclusion. Of course, they don't know it's fake. And counting money is a great anesthetic. It's much more significant than people who are just counting paper. So, to summarize that, if you've been socially excluded, you're more sensitive to pain, and especially if you've been socially excluded, counting money instead of counting paper works as a painkiller. So people actually rated significantly less pain if they'd been counting banknotes rather than if they'd been counting equivalent pieces of paper. Another variation on this theme, before people put their hands in hot water, they did some chatting about two different topics. One was a neutral topic, i.e. the weather. One was losing money. And the people who talked about losing money rated the hot water as significantly more painful than if they'd been talking about the weather. And again, for the socially excluded, the difference is much larger. So those people who have been socially excluded are rating the pain as almost twice as high if they'd been talking about money loss compared to if they'd been talking about the weather. So if you think pain is a physical thing that depends on the temperature of the water and people's sensitivity on their hands, well, it clearly isn't just that, because it's related to what's on their mind, what they've been talking about. And talking about losing money is literally a painful topic, and especially so when people are already feeling social exclusion. So why is this? Well, a quote from the research, quote, "The mere idea of money has considerable psychological power, enough to alter reactions to social exclusion and even to physical pain," unquote. So money is working as a kind of social painkiller. How come just touching money reduces people's pain? Well, thinking about money makes most people feel strong and independent. They're not dependent on other people because they've got plenty of money. So if they need help, they can buy it. So money effectively reduces people's natural desire for friendship, because they don't rely on their friends, they rely on their money. Does this help us understand the typical image of a miser who's counting his money? Maybe he hasn't got friends, but he's feeling secure, he's feeling comfort from his money. Does this help us understand how the super rich feel like keeping their debt on the books, keeping their paper money total increasing is more important than maintaining social relationships or even maintaining a healthy ecosystem? Now, the third section is called the dictator game. And this is actually an exception because this is economics research. This is called behavioral economics, which is when you look at how people actually behave in the real world. It's not quite real world. You're making up this game, then people are playing it. So the dictator game is very simple. Actually, in terms of game theory, it's so simple it's not actually a game. Nominally, it involves two players, A and B. A is the dictator. B actually doesn't play an active part in the game. He just sits there. Player A, the dictator, is given a certain amount of money by the economics researcher, say $10, and his task, because he's the dictator, is to say how much he will get and how much the other player, player B, will get. Now, economic theory, considering he doesn't actually have to give any money to player B, economic theory says, look, everybody's a selfish maximizer, so player A is going to maximize his utility, he's going to get as much money as he can, i.e. all the money, so he won't give any money to player B. So that's the theory. And what about the practice? Well, that does happen, but quite often player A says, okay, well, there's two of us, we've just got some money, half each then. So the dictator, who has the power to keep all the money, a lot of the time splits it 50-50. So that's a complete paradox. According to conventional economic theory, which says everybody wants more for themselves and they don't give a stuff about anyone else. So that's the dictator game, and that's the first step of a more complicated one called the ultimatum game, where, again, the dictator, player A, has a chance to split the money between himself and player B, but this time player B actually has a choice. He can either accept the split, okay, that's how much money we've got, or he can say, no, let's just give it all back to the experimenter. We neither of us get anything. So, how would you play that game if you're the dictator? Would you split it 50-50? Remember, you can take as much money as you want. Would you take all the money? Would you maybe take 90% of the money, take $9, and give the other guy one? Well, it's up to him whether anybody gets any money. If he wants, he can say, well, I'm not happy, we'll cancel that. Nobody gets any. Well, economic theory, remember, predicts everybody's a selfish maximizer. Everybody's rational. So the second player, because the choice is either to get whatever he's allocated by the dictator or to get nothing. Well, nothing is the lowest possible result. So economic theory says player B will always accept the offer, as long as it's more than nothing. So player A knows that. So if he's allowed to split the dollars how he likes, he'll give player B the lowest he can, $1, and he'll take $9. Player B will say, shucks, $1 is better than nothing. Player A gets $9, that's nothing to do with me. I want a dollar. So economic theory says you get a very unjust split from the dictator. Player B will accept it. Of course, in reality, how would you feel? Somebody decides to pocket 90% of the money and only offer you 10. A lot of the time, player B says, well, stuff you. If you're not going to be fair with me, neither of us will get any money. Hand it back to the experimenter. So this is two problems for the traditional economic model. In the dictator game, you've got complete choice over who gets how much money. Why don't people just take it all? In the ultimatum game, why does player B reject the unfair splits a lot of the time? Well, the truth is very simple. Most people like things to be fair. Whether it's a matter of they don't want to let somebody get more than their fair share, or they don't want somebody walking out of the experiment with nothing, this is a reality to which Modern economic theory is blind. And if you're a psychopath, of course, you don't like things to be fair. You don't give a stuff about anyone else. You think, how do you get the most? So is that just a coincidence that that's exactly what modern economic theory predicts? Either way, this is slightly an embarrassing corner for modern economic theory, this behavioural economics. And a lot of people have said, oh, well, that's because you didn't explain it carefully enough to people. If they understood, then I'm sure they would have behaved more selfishly. Now, I don't buy that because it's been replicated in a lot of different studies, a lot of different cultures. Now, some people have said, well, these people are economically not literate. They ought to behave more selfishly. If they did, perhaps the economy would be working better, because after all, it's set up on the assumption that people aren't going to be concerned about other people. So if they are, well, that's breaking our model. So I don't know whether people have cited this as evidence that we need economic literacy. I consider that's putting the cart before the horse. Why make a model of people being selfish, then say, yeah, people don't fit this model, we better change the people. We better make them more selfish. I think, no, people have a natural tendency to try and be fair. Well, that makes a lot of sense. You're living with people. You don't want to shortchange them. You've got to treat people right, and they'll treat you right. This is understood. This is the golden rule. This is understood by all cultures everywhere. Yeah, not by psychopaths. But why do we have this economic model which seems to think this is strange behavior? I think time for a new economic model. Now, the fourth section, subliminal effect, is a very simple experiment. The experimenter said, pull up a chair. And people did. It was a chair on wheels. And then they measured how close to the experimenter did the subject pull up his chair. Now, why was this of significance? Well, in the background, there was a computer monitor on the desk of the experimenter with one of three different screensavers showing. One was a fish tank. You've probably seen that fish swimming around. One was a blank screen. One was dollar bills animated. So why do you think that might have affected the way that people sat? How do you think that could have changed the distance? Well, the difference between the fish screensaver and the blank screen was negligible. People sat, on average, about 31 or 32 inches away from the experimenter. The money screensaver, however, was different. People sat, on average, about 46 inches away from the experimenter. So, having money not mentioned, just in the background, people were subtly reminded that there is a thing called money. Why did those people sit nearly 50% further away from the experimenter? Because they were reminded of money. And the next result was even more dramatic. Having sat down, people were asked, well, we've got a choice here. You can either work with somebody else on the task we give you, or you can work on your own. Which would you rather? So how would the money screensaver be different from the other screensavers? Would people want to work together, or would they want to work alone? Well, fish screensaver, we have about 74% of people wanted to work together. The blank screensaver, 68%. The money screensaver, 18%. So there's money floating around behind the experimenter on his computer monitor, which nobody tells the experimental subjects is important. It's just visible in the background, they think, by chance, but has a dramatic effect on the number of people who choose to work together. It shrinks from about 70-odd percent to slightly less than 20. So why did the money screensaver make people sit further away and prefer to work alone rather than work together? Well, experimenters reported, quote, in summary, we found that small reminders of money produce large changes in behavior, unquote. So even subtle reminders of money are making people feel more independent, You're independent. You don't want to work with other people. Maybe you think, well, they're going to have to get my money if I get a reward for doing this task. So money basically encourages competition rather than collaboration. Now, this too is a problem in a world where more and more things are done for money. Do we want people to be competing with other people when they could be collaborating? I haven't got a problem with competition when it's fun. Playing football, playing cricket is fine. What about competing for things to eat? I would rather be working together on most of the problems of the world than trying to compete with other people, because they're large problems and we could do better working together. Of course, there's a small elite, call them the 1%, who want the other 99% to be competing with one another, not collaborating. We've seen endlessly on the show about divide and conquer techniques such as racism, religious wars, sexism. It seems to me that perhaps the most effective divide and conquer technique to keep people competing with other people is money. If you're a farmer, your village has a good harvest, you know everybody's going to be eating well. Unless you're in the market mechanism when you're selling the crops, in that case, you want everybody else in the village to have a bad harvest, because then you're going to get a higher price for your goods. The fifth section is called Selfishness of Economists, and it looks at some studies that have been done since the 1990s comparing economics graduates with other graduates. Embarrassingly enough, they give less money to charity, and when they're in these behavioral economics experiments, like the dictator game, the ultimatum game, they tend to behave more selfishly. So, why is that, I wonder? Is it because they've been made economically literate? They've learned that the most rational, sensible way to behave is to say, well, stuff you, I want the most for myself. Does studying economics increase selfishness? Or is it just the fact that the most selfish people are naturally attracted to the discipline of economics? Or is it a bit of both? Well, the result is still unclear. So, to summarize the five sections, economists are more selfish than non-economists. Subtle reminders of money make people behave in different ways, make them more interested to compete, less interested in sharing and working together. Having lots of money reduces people's interest in friendship, and money works as a kind of social painkiller. Money doesn't always motivate people, and people, when they think about money, behave in a more selfish fashion. Economics says, well, that's because people are selfish. But research into their behavior doesn't bear this out. People are not as selfish as the economic models predict.